Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn. How are you today,
And
Mom?
hello, everyone. Well, pretty good, pretty good. Like I keep saying, spring's coming, but winter's dragging its feet.
It's true, but it looks like a pretty nice day here today.
Yeah, we'll be fine.
Yeah, we're in Iowa, which winters can be a little long here. It just depends.
Yeah.
Well, we have a really great book for young adults today.
Oh, gosh, yes.
And so our author is Veera Hiranandani, who earned her MFA in creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College. She's the author of The Whole Story of Half a Girl, which was named a Sydney Taylor Notable Book and a South Asian Book Award finalist. She's a former book editor and now teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College's Writing Institute and Writopia Lab. So I'm sure we'll hear more about that. And her new book is called The Night Diary. And it is a historical novel for young adults that addresses a period of time that a lot of American readers probably don't know much about. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Veera.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So explain the setting of your book.
Sure. So my book is about a girl, 12-year-old Nisha, who has to leave her home during the partition of India in 1947. So this happened in August on midnight, basically at the same exact time when India gained independence from the British, between August 15th and August 14th and August 15th in 1947. And it really tells the story of her journey, really her own diary of her journey when she has to leave her home in what is now Mirpurkhast, Pakistan, and go over to the new border of India into Jodhpur, India. And it's the same journey that my father had to make when he was 9 with his family. And this was something I had always grown up hearing about. I didn't hear about it anywhere else other than my family for a very long time.
I think the first exposure that a lot of Americans in more recent times had to this historical event was in Slumdog Millionaire, maybe, that there was a little bit of reference to it there.
Sure. And I think growing up for me, the first time I saw it was in the movie Gandhi.
Mm.
And I was 11 when I saw that movie, and we all went as a family. And that movie focuses very directly on India's independence and partition. And it's really about that. I mean, of course, it's about Gandhi's life, but most of the movie is about that time. And it was the first time that I had seen this word. You know, I heard that's why my father had to leave when India split into Pakistan and India, and Muslims in India went to Pakistan and Hindus and non-Muslims went to India, and there was a lot of fighting and a lot of violence, and I knew it was a scary time, and that's kind of all I knew, and that my father's family made it safely, and that was all I knew. And when I saw this movie, first of all, I didn't understand the magnitude of the history. I didn't realize what a huge piece of global history it was, how many people were affected during that time. 14 million people, or over 14 million people, migrated during that time. And so it's really the largest human migration in modern history. And between 1 and 2 million people died. And so I was so shocked that this was the same partition that my father had been talking about, but I think he hadn't wanted to share all of the details because it's so difficult to wrap your head around, especially for a young person. So I think he was protecting me from some of those details. But at the same time, when you're young and you know you're not being told the whole story, you become more curious, certainly. Excuse me. And not only do you become more curious, but in some ways, the things that are left out are almost more frightening because you have that sense as a child, oh, they're not telling me this because it's too hard, it's too scary. So it's always kind of balancing that idea of how much, I'm a parent now, and so it's how much should you share in that way. So that movie really was very pivotal for me, and that it stuck with me. And I also felt like, why don't I know about this outside of my family? Why aren't people,
right.
Why am I not learning about this in school? This is such a huge piece of global history. Mm-hmm. But there are so many things in this country that we don't know about that happened and happens around the world. So that was,
that's true.
So that was very pivotal for me, and I really held it. And I didn't know I would grow up to be a writer, but when I did, I knew I really felt compelled to shape a story around this period of time.
Well, I was in junior high during this time, and and I had a teacher who admired Gandhi greatly, and she would tell us about him, but she didn't tell us about the whole situation. So I knew nothing about it, you know.
It's a very common experience.
I think this book is a must read for high school and college students, because it, especially, okay, your author's notes in the back, they start with that and gives them the picture of what's going on, and then they start to read her story. I mean, it's just really, I couldn't put it down.
No, just thank you.
Amazing.
Thank you. There's really a lot we can learn from this time, and ultimately it's about how fragile we can be as human beings and how quickly xenophobia and just differences can become so glaring and become so divisive. I didn't know when I was writing the book 5 years ago that some of those themes would be resonating as loudly as they are today, and also connecting with the experience of a refugee, and this girl is a refugee. She has to leave her home, although she becomes a refugee in her own country, in a sense, which is confusing.
Yeah.
But those two experiences of that fragile society, you know, I think we're kind of under the feeling that we experience the feeling of sort of a false sense of safety often. And somebody who's gone through something like partition, like my father, knows that things can change literally overnight. How hard we have to work to have open minds and accept differences and fight to protect a peaceful society. And so things like partition, events like partition, can remind us of that so we don't repeat the same mistakes.
Vera, how long was your father's family in what is now Pakistan before the partition?
He was there until he was 9.
But, I mean, had the family been there for many generations?
Oh, you know, I don't know how far back. I know that I think definitely at least 100 years probably, but I don't know past that.
Who in the world thought this was a good idea? How could anyone think this was a good idea to disrupt so many people's lives?
Well, that's the thing. I think there were so many layers of confusion and misunderstandings. I think there was a real desire to give people equality, actually. So I think there were a lot of people who felt like Hindus had more power in the government in India. And once India became independent, Muslims wouldn't have the same equality and would be treated as a minority and not as equally. And that was a legitimate concern. The way the problem was solved was not the right answer, obviously, and also was very rushed by the British, who really sped up the timeline. They were the ones who drew the lines. So there were a lot of needs that weren't being met during this conflict. I don't really get into kind of those opinions. And when you talk to people about partition, there are a lot of strong opinions about what could have been done to prevent this. Was it right? Was it wrong? And I tend to look at things as diplomatically as I can and really empathize. I really do empathize with all the different needs going on. And I do think the leaders involved, Jinnah, Nehru, Gandhi, were trying, and the British Viceroy, Lord Mountbatten, were trying to avoid conflict and were trying to solve problems, but everybody made mistakes. And I don't think anybody could imagine what would happen. And even my father's family, they thought that they could stay. You know, not everybody knew. I think when these lines were drawn, it wasn't immediately understood that this group of people has to go here and this group of people has to go here. It was more about who was going to have power in the government.
Right.
But it you know, it was this wave of frustration and anger that had been building for a while. And once, I think, you know, the first act of violence was committed, it just set off a real wave
and
a cycle of violence, that of revenge. And then a lot of people just got caught in the middle. So my father's family just felt like they thought they might be able to stay. And then a month went by and they just felt like things were getting closer and the news of unrest was increasing. And my grandparents basically one night said, we have to get out of here, and packed bags and got on a train and made it safely. And they were very lucky. A lot of people got on trains and didn't survive, going in both directions. Mm-hmm. So,
So how many people died in that transition?
Well, the numbers aren't completely exact. So I like to say between 1 and 2 million, because seen some books and texts say 2 million, some say 1 million, anywhere in between. So I think it was about, and it could have been even over 2 million. I mean, nobody's 100% sure, but just an enormous loss of life.
Wow.
Well, you know, I'm sure that the phenomenon of crowd mania took over sometimes in that situation too, because people who were neighbors with, you know, one another and had been friends all at once, this whole thing took over and they just, you know, kind of lost it for a while. I mean, it's so sad, but I can see how that happens.
Exactly. I think it's really motivated by a real fear, you know, and just desire to protect oneself. And I think that's a very human instinct that may only be tapped into in a very particular time of threat. And so, you know, the more I research this time, in some ways I understand it less, because it's a little incomprehensible. And so I really wanted Nisha to be able to ask those questions in the book that I had growing up and continue to have over time. So I felt like having a young narrator who doesn't necessarily know all the political forces at work would only kind of hear it, see a headline, hear a snippet of her father talking to her grandmother, and get it in pieces the way kids understand information. Certainly back then, I think kids have so much access to information now that it's very different. But this is the way she would have probably experienced it then. And then, of course, she has her mother, who's no longer living, is Muslim, and her father is Hindu, and her grandmother is Hindu. So I wanted the family to be seen as a Hindu family going in the direction that a Hindu family would be going in, because that was what my father's family experienced and what I was most familiar with. But I also wanted her to really ask the question, where do I belong if I have a connection to both of these sides that are supposed to be suddenly against each other, even though we were all living peacefully in our neighborhood together? So that was why I created the character of Nisha in the way that she is.
And was this an unusual situation where to have mixed parentage like that?
Yes, it would have been unusual. It did happen. Sort of everything you can imagine kind of happens at any point in time. But it was rare, and they would have been real pioneers. But I think of my parents, you know, part of the reason I also did that is because I come from a mixed background, and I think of my parents who got married. They ended up meeting in Poughkeepsie, actually, of all places. Mm-hmm. You know, my father grew up in what is now Pakistan and ended up meeting my mom in Poughkeepsie. And my mom is Jewish and was born in Brooklyn. And they were pioneers, in a sense. You know, they were married in 19, hope I have the dates right, but 1968. And
were they hippies?
No, not really. They were, I think they were sort of, it's amazing to me because they weren't, you know, they weren't these sort of active, rebellious people. My father was working at IBM at the time. My mother was a teacher. They met, my mom had a party. Apparently my father and his two roommates crashed the party and brought roses and came to the party. And that's how they met. And they, you know, they just simply fell in love, and their families were not happy about their union, and eventually came around, but they really, they had to elope, and it was purely out of love. So that's the story I grew up with, and that's how, why I exist. And so, you know, I wanted to kind of replicate that relationship, that even though people may not understand or it's not what people do or your families might be at first upset, they didn't, that was kind of how powerful that idea of love was. And it's really, I just think of how brave my parents were and how brave Papa was to do that, and what, you know, Anisha coming out of that. And I've always had to then navigate my multiple identities. So I'm certainly not with the kinds of stakes that Nisha is in the book, but that was something I could connect to.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Veera Hiranandani. I don't think I got that quite right.
Veera Hiranandani.
Hiranandani.
Yes.
And author of The Night Diary. Now, Veera, is that, you know, it's in the form of a diary. It's letters that Nisha's writing to her mother who died in childbirth, and so whom she never knew. What were the sort of the pluses and minuses of writing in a diary format?
Yes. It was difficult at times. I tend to like to give myself some kind of boundary, or really know that boundary before I start writing something. And the boundary may just be, or the rules just may be, a point of view. I'm writing this in first person present tense, and I just sort of know that, and I kind of know my time frame. So I don't have sort of everything to play with. I want to have those boundaries so I can make more careful choices of what I'm trying to do. And this was probably the strongest boundary I've given myself. I felt like it was going to give the reader a very intimate view of her life, and this was also a character I had in my mind, that she was very shy and had a lot of difficulty speaking to people outside of her family, so she was only going to show this side of herself in a diary, and this is also the first time she's writing in a diary, so this is a real discovery of her voice in a new way that she's never discovered. So she's going to be kind of experimenting with that and finding a new freedom on these pages. But there were times I talked with my editor in the very beginning, and we wondered if it would be feel too closed or maybe suffocate the book a little bit to keep it just in diary form. And should we step outside of that narrative and have another point of view, another niche on the page, maybe a third person version. And I tried it a little bit, and we ultimately felt like it was stronger this way. And the thing is, I had to sort of ask the readers to take a leap with me, because there are times that I am describing things in diary format through Nisha that a 12-year-old writing in diary may not take the time to flesh out. So you hear dialogue, you see scenes in a way that I felt like were needed to fully understand the story, and maybe not 100% realistic of what she would be compelled to do in her diary. She sort of says in the beginning, I want to write it like a story and tell you everything, because she's writing to her mother. So there's that idea that she does want to fill in that space for her mother. But I also felt like the reader will either go with it or they won't, And so I hope that, you know, that was, I just hope that it would be believable and successful.
Well, it works out well that she is able to use her brother's actions, because her twin brother is the exact opposite of her, personality-wise. And, you know, so that works out well, I think.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, he does many of the things she can't do.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, and she doesn't always see it, he has a hard time just sitting still quietly and observing things around him. So sometimes he'll miss things that she sees.
Mm-hmm.
He won't ask questions that she's asking, but then she'll ask him to ask it for her.
Yeah, right.
they make a good team that way.
Yes.
Did you have the character, the family sort of dynamics and the people in the family all kind of set before you started writing, or did they appear as you wrote?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I had it pretty set. I tend to do a loose outline. I'm a big believer in a loose outline. And I also teach this way when I'm talking to students. I feel like, and of course it's such a personal process, and there are some people who really want to have that experience of just going on a hike and they're going to throw away the map and they're going to see where they go. I'm not that sort of confident in myself. I get too nervous to have no idea where I'm going. So I tend to flesh out the family structure, the time frame, the general plot. I don't like to over outline because I do feel like it can take too much mystery out of it. And I do want to discover some things. I do want to end up in some places that I didn't expect. But at the same time, when I get a little lost, I want to be able to look at my outline and say, what was I trying to do around this point in the story? I like to know who the main characters are going to be. Sometimes there might be, you know, a conversation that a character has, and that conversation with maybe a passerby suddenly feels like an important character. So there might be some minor characters that have a bigger space in the book that I didn't expect. But usually all the main characters are the ones that I wanted and kind of set out with at the beginning.
Can you give us an example of something that surprised you during the writing of this, of The Night
mm-hmm.
Diary?
Sure. Well, I started it where she was writing in a diary and her mother had died giving birth to her. So that was all set. But Nisha was just writing in a diary to herself. And as I wrote, I felt like there just wasn't something driving her to create these entries the way she was, to be explaining things to herself the way she was. Something wasn't quite lining up. And then it just dawned on me, maybe, you know, halfway through the manuscript of a first draft, what people read in my, you know, in the published book is like the 25th draft. But halfway through that first draft many years ago, it just dawned on me, she's talking to her mother. That's who she's talking to in this diary. And that's why she's sort of fleshing it out and explaining it in a way that she wants somebody else to see. And she desperately wants to create this mother that she'll never know, this relationship on the page. And it just clicked, and for me, it really made complete sense, and I went back and started over with a clearer sense of purpose.
You say that what we read is about the 25th draft. Is there a point in there where you get sort of tired of the material, or is it always exciting to you?
No, I absolutely get tired of it. I would be lying if I said I didn't. That's why I think often it's good to step away for a while. So when I do feel that creeping in, that kind of almost, I've been through this so many times, it's too close, I'm just not seeing it in an exciting way anymore, that is a signal to me to put it down for a while. And then usually when I do that, and whether it's a week or two or even a month, and then I come back, it refreshes me, and I find that energy again, or I have been thinking about it. You know, I never sort of stop thinking about the story. So that is an act of writing. It's a creative process that's ongoing. And I usually come back with some new insights and some new ideas that I wasn't always aware that I was having. But that's important. And then there are times, you know, towards the end of something, after years of working on it, everybody working on it, it was me and my editor, who it was incredibly insightful, and I really trusted her. She, you know, you just say, okay, I think it's ready now. I'm sure I could carefully read this book again and find places that I wanted to change or revise. And I think that's very common for many writers, that revision process never stops, but it eventually you just decide to stop it. Something just happens, and I don't know if I can bring anything new to the story anymore. It's clear enough for me.
Right.
And let's hope for the best.
So how long did you work on The Night Diary? How long was the writing process?
Probably from the first moment to published book, about 5 years, I would say.
Okay. And you were working with an editor from fairly early in that process?
No, that was really the last. It took me about 2 to 3 years to get the draft to that point where I wanted to submit it. And so I had some feedback with my agent. And then even before that, I have a writing group that is one of the best things that's ever happened to me, with 3 other writers. And they saw very early drafts. And we have been together for many years, and we really trust each other. So I never write alone in that sense. My husband also works, reads my drafts. So there are a lot of people involved and looking at the draft over time. So my editor, she saw the draft after, you know, she probably saw draft 15, you know, in that sense,
right,
or draft 20.
Right.
And, you know, some drafts are bigger than other drafts. Some is just a little change here and there. The early ones are pretty big overhauls. And then the last year or two, we did 1 or 2 bigger revisions and 1 or 2 smaller revisions together.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about how your writing group works. What's the process of how you share your work?
Well, it just sort of happened by chance that I met one of the writers, Sheila Chari, and through a mutual friend, and then she knew she knew the other two writers, Sayantani Dasgupta and Heather Tomlinson, and she connected all of us, and we just clicked. We were all at a similar place of publishing our work. We had a similar amount of experience, but also very different writers, but also all writing for young people. And this was about, I don't know, 6 years ago, I would say. And we meet once every 6 weeks, and usually 2 of us submit writing, and it could be anywhere from, you know, 10 pages to 50 pages. 50 pages is usually our max. And we meet and we go around and we try to just help the person who's submitted to see their work more clearly. That's the ultimate goal. So, you know, sometimes the feedback might be critical. We try to be honest with each other. But at the same time, it's really just to encourage each other. Oh, I see what you're trying to do here. I bet you could do this more. You could bring this out. And it's incredibly useful. And it's also to not feel alone in the writing process and to give us each other deadlines. I mean, that is one of the maybe the most important thing. Because sometimes when you're not on a deadline, you haven't sold your manuscript yet, nobody really cares if you write it or not. Only you are going to care. But it's nice to have a few other people that also care and are waiting for your writing. So I think that's the most important thing that we give each other.
That makes a lot of sense. In the parts that you're submitting to your writers group, do you give it to them ahead of time, a week ahead of time, or?
Right. About a week ahead of time, and we just submit it by email.
Right.
And we've become pretty comfortable with each other, so it's rough, and that's okay. And that's okay, and that's a real freedom, actually, to find people that you don't feel like you have to write this perfect thing for. You know, I hope, I try to keep that atmosphere in my workshops that I teach as well. I want people to write, to submit things that they're really not sure about, that they really have questions about, because it actually isn't that helpful if you write something to what you feel like is this state of doneness, you know, this kind of, I've perfected this. And then somebody has feedback and questions, that can feel really just very devastating. And we've all experienced that.
Yeah.
People who write and submit, it can be devastating. So you want to be in that place of openness. You want to be in that place of, I really don't know how this is feeling. It's very new. It's very rough. What do you see here? You know, what do you think I'm trying to do here? And that openness, I think, is just can create a real freedom, a real artistic freedom. That it's not always easy to get to that place, and it's not always easy to feel that trust with the people that you're submitting. Even one person, it doesn't necessarily have to be a whole workshop full of people.
Right.
But if one person can give you that, it's great.
How important in your writer's group do you think it is that you are all on a similar, in a similar place in your careers, that you don't have someone who's, you know, bestseller and someone else who hasn't even submitted yet?
I think it's important. I don't think it has to be that way. It depends on how comfortable people are and how okay they are with where they are in their writing. And
right.
We've been at different places at different times, but I think we have a level of experience that is similar. So I think that builds a certain trust. None of us came into the group as people who hadn't been thinking and writing for years. I think it would be hard to have somebody in the group who is just making their first attempt at their first piece of writing. They, I think, would benefit from being in a group where everybody's kind of in that place.
Right.
So I think it's important. But then, of course, there are different times where one of us, you know, has published this and then, you know, years go by, or another person is feeling more frustrated than somebody else. So, of course, we're in different places, but just the general amount of experience and years of writing is similar.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Veera Hiranandani, author of The Night Diary, which is published by Penguin Random House in the Penguin Young Readers. Who is that, the same publisher that you had for your previous book, Veera?
It's the same publisher, different imprints. So Dial Books for Young Readers, which is part of Penguin. It's so confusing to keep track of who these days. So this is the first book I've done with Dial. I wrote a chapter book series called CBG Green, and that was with Grosset and Dunlap, which is another imprint of Penguin. And my first book, The Whole Story of Half a Girl, was first published by Delacorte Press, which was an imprint, is still an imprint of, well, it was an imprint of Random House then, and now it's Penguin Random House. So they're all under the umbrella of Penguin Random House now.
Okay.
Which is convenient.
So what was the title of your chapter book series?
It's called CBG Green.
What was that about?
And that is, I wrote four books in the series, and it's younger, so it's for maybe first, second, third graders, maybe fourth graders, depending on reading level. And that book is about a girl named Phoebe who discovers that she's a foodie. So it's much lighter in tone and subject matter, but she discovers that she's just not happy with her chicken nuggets at lunch anymore, and this girl from France moves to town, and she has these beautiful lunches, and it kind of ignites this desire to understand food and to take more risks. And it really came out of what I was, I obviously like to, in all my books, I write about food. I think that it's something I really enjoy doing, expressing a character through food. I enjoy cooking and eating even more. It's also a way for me to sort of connect to both sides of my family. I always say that, you know, samosas and chicken matzo ball soup are my favorite comfort foods from different sides of my family. So she's somebody who discovers that she's a foodie. And I just was seeing around me a lot of things that we do in this country with kids and food that, you know, the children's menus at restaurants, it's often telling kids this is what you're supposed to like and this is what you're supposed to eat, which is basically, you know, spaghetti and chicken nuggets. And some kids are totally happy with that or just naturally more restrictive eaters. And some kids aren't that way and maybe they don't get to sort of explore it more. So I wanted to create a book for kids who wanted to be inspired that way.
I have a really cute story about my grandson who is half Taiwanese. And
okay.
One day he was about five, I think, and we had gone to see the ducks at the mm-hmm. pond and feed the ducks. And then we went to a Chinese restaurant that was a real, you know, authentic Chinese restaurant, and it had all the carcasses hanging up front and mm-hmm. it had tanks of the fish and the, you know, crabs and lobsters and so forth. And the kids loved going there because they could look at the fish and the lobsters. But my grandson noticed the carcasses hanging up, and he says, "What's that?" And I said, "Well, that's a duck." It was, you know, he was pointing at a duck carcass. I go, "That's a duck." And he goes, "They killed the duck?" And I go, "Yeah, they killed the duck." And he goes, "Why?" I said, "Well, because people like to eat it." He goes, "Oh, yeah, I love duck." And my son says, "What are you talking about? You've never had duck." And his mom says, "Yes, he has, at his other grandmother's, who's Chinese." And,
right.
So we ordered the duck at the restaurant, and he loves the duck.
And he was okay. You know, I remember with my own kids that moment of this chicken is the same chicken that we saw at the farm, you know, and there's that moment where some kids just suddenly become vegetarians right there and then.
Right.
And some kids are okay with it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. My grandson is a bit of a restrictive eater, but he loves duck and he loves shrimp, you know, which are things that as a kid I never even tasted and wouldn't have thought of having. And
exactly.
Yeah. But he also loves the mac and cheese and chicken nuggets on the children's menu. So.
Sure. Sure. And I have one. I have a son and daughter, and my son is more, he would be happy with pasta and chicken nuggets and all of that all the time. But because I've exposed him to a lot more, then he's found some other things that he likes that maybe he wouldn't. And then I have a daughter who has always just been interested in everything since she was very young, and it has very little to do with me. It was just the way her palate is. So I find that really interesting about, you know, why people's relationship to food and their background and how they grew up eating and what they like now. And of course I explore that with Nisha in The Night Diary, because food is a way for her to express herself, and she has a very positive connection with the family cook who teaches her how to cook and teaches her this other way that she can express herself. And cooking can be really empowering for people. I know for me, it always felt that way as a kid, like, wow, I made that. I baked something.
Oh,
I did
yeah.
that. Yeah.
Yeah, that the so, kids, my grandkids love making homemade noodles with me. You know, it's...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, and well, also all those family memories that can be attached to
cooking. Oh, yes.
Cooking.
So, Vera, before we run out of time, why don't you read a little bit from the opening of The Night Diary?
I would be happy to.
Great.
So this is the very first entry. Kind of sets the scene. Just get the phone where I can hold it. Okay. Dear Mama, I know you know what happened today at 6 a.m. 12 years ago. How could you not? It was the day we came and you left, but I don't want to be sad today. I want to be happy and tell you everything. I'll start at the beginning. You probably already know what I'm telling you, but maybe you don't. Maybe you haven't been watching. I like turning 12 so much already. It's the biggest number I've ever been, but it's an easy number, easy to say, easy to count, easy to split in half. I wonder if Emil thinks about you on this day like I do. I wonder if he likes being 12. We woke up at a little before 7. Emil and I usually sleep through our birth minutes. And then when we wake up, we stand next to the last mark we etched into the wall with a sharp rock. No one else knows it's there. I do it for Emil, and he does mine, and then we compare how much we've grown since last year. Emil has finally caught up with me. Papa says someday Emil will tower over all of us. That's hard to imagine. Papa gave me your gold chain with a small ruby stone hanging from it. He started giving me the jewelry when I was 7. Now I have 2 gold bangles, 2 gold rings, small emerald and gold hoop earrings, and the ruby necklace. Papa said I should save the jewelry for special occasions, but lately there are none, so I wear all the jewelry at once and never take it off. I don't know where he keeps all of it, but each year on my birthday, another piece appears at my bedside in a dark blue velvet box with gold trim. When you open it, the blue satin lining winks back at you. Papa always asks for the box back after I take out the jewelry. Secretly, I want the box more than the jewelry. I want it to be all mine and never have to give it back. I could find any old thing, a pebble, a leaf, a pistachio shell, and put it in the box. Like magic, these things would get to be special for at least a day. Maybe he'll let me have it when your jewelry runs out. I want to tell you about this diary I'm writing in. Kazi gave it to me this morning wrapped in brown paper, tied with a piece of dried grass. He never gives me gifts on my birthday. I once read an English story where a little girl got a big pink cake and presents wrapped in shiny paper and bows for her birthday. I thought about the little gifts Kazi gives us all the time, pieces of candy under our pillows, or a ripe tomato from the garden, sliced, salted, and sprinkled with chili pepper on a plate. Cake and bows must be nice, but is anything better than a perfect tomato? The diary is covered in purple and red silk, decorated with small sequins and bits of mirrored glass sewn in. The paper is rough, thick, and the color of butter. It is not lined, which I like. I've never had a diary before. When Kazi gave it to me, he said it was time to start writing things down and that I was the one to do it. He said someone needs to make a record of the things that will happen because the grown-ups will be too busy. I'm not sure what he thinks is going to happen, but I've decided I'm going to write in it every day if I can. I want to explain things to you as if I'm writing a storybook, like The Jungle Book, except without all the animals. I want to make it real so you can imagine it. I want to remember what everyone says and does, and I won't know the ending until I get there. Kazi also gave Emil 5 charcoal drawing pencils. 5. He also made us rice kheer with our puris. I'm not sure there is anything better tasting in the world. Emil, who normally eats too fast, makes his pudding last extra long, eating the smallest bites he can. I think he just does it so I have to watch him long after I've finished. Every so often, he'll look up and smile. I pretend I don't care. Sometimes he saves his sweets for me, but not rice kheer. Today we were running late, though, and Emil couldn't spend forever eating his kheer because Dottie took our plates away and told us to get ready. Emil started grumbling about school and how he wished he was a grown-up and could work at the hospital like Papa instead. The drums sound better at a distance, Dottie said, like she always does, and rushed us out the door. Here's another secret, and don't be mad. Emil and I didn't go to school. We headed all the way out of town to the sugarcane field and tried to walk through it like a maze. We broke off pieces to chew. Later, we stopped under a shady tree. Emil found bugs to draw, and I read. After, we bought potato pakoras at the roadside cart in town, hoping no one would ask us why we weren't in school. The pakoras tasted crisp and extra salty. Emil thinks they're too salty, but I like the sting on my tongue that stays long after I've finished eating. Emil would rather draw and play all day instead of going to school. He would rather do anything besides school. He draws very well. Did you know that? I don't hate school, but I didn't want Emil to be alone on our birthday. When Papa finds out we didn't go to school, he'll be much angrier at Emil than he will at me. That's how it is with Papa and Emil. It hasn't always been like that. Emil used to be Papa's favorite. I think because Emil was always louder, happier, and funnier than I am. But now, because Emil isn't small and cute, Papa is different. Should I keep going?
Sure.
Okay. When we were about 7 or 8, Emil ran away. That's when it started. Papa came home from a long day at the hospital, and during dinner, he told Emil to stop smiling so much that it made him look ridiculous. This only made Emil smile more. Then Papa said, Emil, you can't read. You play around too much and draw little pictures. You must be more serious or you will become nothing. Maybe I should leave. Then you'll be happy, Emil said. He waited for Papa to say something, but Papa didn't. He just turned back to his food. Emil got up and walked straight out of the house. An hour went by, and he didn't come back. So I went out to look for him. I looked everywhere, around the garden, the shed, Kazi and Mahit's cottages, all the places he might go. I even looked in the pantry and in Papa's closet. Papa acted like nothing was happening. But I told Kazi that I couldn't find Emil anywhere, and he told Dadi, and Dadi told Papa, so Papa went out with a lantern. I stayed awake in my bed, wondering what I would do if Emil never came back. I couldn't imagine being in this house, in this life without him. I heard Papa return, and I waited for Emil's voice or his footsteps, but I didn't hear anything and began to cry, holding my doll D tight. At some point, I fell asleep. When I woke at first light, Emil slept soundly in his bed next to mine. I wasn't sure if I had dreamed the whole thing. Emil, I said, poking him awake, standing over him. Where did you go? Does Papa know you're back? Papa knows I'm back, Emil said in a dull voice. I walked into town, but then I kept going. I didn't want to stop, but Papa found me. Is Papa mad? I asked. Papa will always be mad at me. It doesn't matter if I smile or don't smile. I'm just not what he wanted. That's not true, I said, and put my hand on his shoulder. He turned away. He might have been right about Papa, though. Since that night he ran away, Papa always seems angry at Emil for being Emil. Papa left a book. Yes.
That's a good place to stop, I think.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah. Yes. So that, and of course, this is before the really dramatic events begin to happen. And
Yes. And sort of setting that, you know, she's given this label as a refugee because that's what they become. But I wanted to show, you know, we hear that label a lot, and behind that label is a person with a very specific, particular experience. And, you know, Nisha is a 12-year-old girl who's has feelings about her father and her brother and her grandmother, and she's, you know, wondering how she can make more friends, and she's wondering what's for dinner, and all of those very normal things. So I wanted to really give that tone to the book before her life turns upside down.
Well, this, I want to, before we're through, I want to urge our young listeners to get this book and read it, because it we need to study history, because if we don't, we're doomed to repeat it. And some of these things are horrendous, and things are happening around the world now that are horrendous. And so we need to know about them. And we need to know that, you know, this happened to people before, too.
Exactly.
Vera, how did you research to get the sort of details of everyday life in this time and place correct? Were you just able to talk to your father, or did you have to do more than that?
I did several things, but that was certainly the base of all of it, really having extensive conversations with my father about everything he could remember. And, you know, he read the manuscript while it was in draft form to help me point out what things didn't feel right or authentic or not what he remembered. But, of course, I wanted to check that out, in a sense, in a larger sense. So I read many personal accounts of partition. There are some books that have collected these testimonies, and then there's an a website called the Partition Archive of 1947.org, which is collecting stories, oral histories of people who've traveled in both directions during partition, and often they explain places they've lived and what their life was like and what it looked like. So just between reading and listening and talking with my father, I eventually started to fill in the picture. And really, I think people in my generation are feeling that urge to collect these histories, because partition isn't something that a lot of people who went through are that excited to talk about. It's a painful time. It's not, some of these stories haven't been passed down. And so, but my father is 80, and he was 9 when he went through this period of time. And people who are older, who remember it even more clearly, are in their 90s or they're not here anymore. And so I think there's this feeling of people in my generation that this is the time we need to preserve this history, to learn from it, and to honor everybody who went through it. Otherwise, we're going to lose it.
You know, so, it's similar to the Holocaust, where many of the Holocaust survivors didn't really talk about it for years and years. But recently, there's been a real effort to make sure that the stories of the survivors are recorded. And
exactly,
we have seen quite a few really fascinating books. We've had a number of authors on Writers' Voices who are telling true Holocaust survivor stories.
Mm-hmm,
and but you're right; they're not going to be around to tell those stories much longer. So now's the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Vera, tell us a little bit about the Sarah Lawrence College's Writing Institute and Writopia Lab. Is this an MFA program or is it something else?
So Sarah Lawrence College has an MFA program, which I went through, which I highly recommend. And it really, many, many years ago, was really my first kind of serious attempt to try to be a writer. And I'm so grateful for that experience there. The Writing Institute is a non-credit writing program. So it's for adults who don't necessarily want to commit to a full MFA program, or they're thinking about an MFA program and they want to take some writing classes at Sarah Lawrence and sort of see how it feels. So those are the courses I teach through that program there. And then Writopia Lab is actually a creative writing program for young people, so ages 8 to 18. And they have a few centers all around the country. So I teach in New York, in Westchester, and they have, and I'm not teaching right now this spring because I've been so busy with the book, but I've taught there for many years, and they have a center in Westchester and New York City, and I think they have one in D.C. and L.A., and it's really a way, it's such a great way for kids who are really interested in creative writing, because they often kids don't do a lot of creative writing, kind of just whatever they want to write. I want to write poems. I want to write stories. I want to write plays. They don't always get the chance to do that at school, so it's such a great outlet for kids to truly connect with that side of themselves.
Is the Writing Institute program an in-residence? Are they all in-residence courses, or can you take them online?
They do offer some online courses. I don't teach online courses. I teach workshops where we have to show up in person. But because that is now such, you know, it's such a great opportunity that people can do that, they do offer several online courses, and I think that's only been increasing in the last few years.
Go ahead, Mom.
No, I think that's really great. That people can, you know, they can have a job and go to work and then come home and have something like that. I think it's wonderful.
Absolutely. So it just gives such a greater access to people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the experience is like taking an online writing course or teaching one. I haven't taught one. So I'm sure I will try my hand at that at some point.
And the courses you teach, are they like over a whole semester, or are there any like week-long workshops where you just...
Yeah. Yeah. So, well, right now I'm teaching an intermediate novel course in the evenings, and that is a workshop for people who have a novel in progress. And we just come together and usually have a craft discussion or a prompt, and then workshop. Everybody workshops pieces of their novel over the course of the semester. So it's a semester-long course once a week, and there's a, you know, a fall semester and a spring semester and then a short summer semester. Mm. And I also do one-day intensive workshops called Mapping Out Your Plot. And they're really just organizational plotting workshops, not for feedback. It's really just bring your ideas, bring your novel in pieces, and let's figure it out. Let's try to organize it. I really, again, I'm in a big believer of a loose plot to just kind of get the broad strokes in place. I think that can really help motivate people when they feel like they don't know where they're going and they feel really stuck. I find it's sort of like cleaning out your closet. You know, this can go here and this can go here, and they're like, oh, now I see what I have. Ah. So I really enjoy teaching that.
Do people come from around the country for those?
No. They're definitely more local, okay. More tri-state area.
Okay.
And maybe I'll figure out a way to teach it online so people can from far away.
Sounds like something I could use.
Yeah, mm-hmm. We all can use it at different points, and so it's a very satisfying course to teach because I do feel like people just feel better when they leave because they've done the work, really thinking organizationally, which a lot of times we just want to keep writing, and you don't want to sort of take the time to sit back and see what you have because you've had that urgency to keep writing. So it's just a nice place for people to stop for a moment and just see what they have.
Sounds great. Well, Vera, I think we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us here today on Writers' Voices.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
And Caroline, do you have some closing words for us today?
Oh, yes, I certainly do. This is from St. Mother Teresa, who spent majority of her life in India trying to help and alleviate some of the suffering of the poor there. Three things in life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. And the third is to be kind.
Yeah.
Thanks again, Vera, and I look forward to your next book.
Oh, thank you.
Please let us know when it comes out.
I will.
And everyone else, see you next week on Writers' Voices.